Major Winters. On May 6th, scouting on his own, he found Goering's officers' quarters and club. In one room, he found a dead German general in full dress uniform, a bullet through his head, ear to ear, a pistol in his hand. He was a two-star general later identified as Kastner. Winters wandered through, kicking open doors, when, Lord, I had never seen anything like this before. In a vaulted cellar, 15 meters by 10 meters, there were row after row of liquor racks stretching from floor to ceiling. The brand names covered the world. The later estimate was that the room held 10,000 bottles. Winters put a double guard on the officers' club entrance and another on the cellar, and he issued an order. No more liquor. Every man in the battalion was to go on the wagon for 7 days. Commenting in 1990 on this improbable order, Winters said, "Now I am no fool. You don't expect an order like that to be carried out 100%, but the message was clear. Keep this situation under control. I don't want a drunken brawl." That afternoon, Winters called Captain Nixon to him. "Nix," he said, "you sober up, and I'll show you something you have never seen before in your life." The next morning, May 7th, Nixon came to Winters, sober, and asked, "What was that you said yesterday that you were going to show me?" Winters got a jeep, and they drove to the officers' club. When Winters opened the door to the cellar, Nixon thought he had died and gone to heaven. He was sure he had when Winters said, "Take what you want, then have each company in Battalion HQ bring around a truck and take a truckload. You are in charge." An alcoholic's dream come true. Paradise beyond description. First choice of all that he could carry from one of the world's great collections, then a chance to let his friends have all they wanted, and the perfect excuse to celebrate. The end of the war had come, and he was still alive. For the company as a whole, the celebration was grand and irresistible. Despite Winter's orders, and despite regular guard duty rotation, there was a party. There had to be. On May 7th, the Germans surrendered in Rennes to General Eisenhower, and word was flashed around Europe to cease fire. Take away the blackout curtains, and let the light of peace shine out. News of the German surrender, Winston Churchill said, was the signal for the greatest outburst of joy in the history of mankind. The men of Easy Company saw to it that Berchtesgaden participated in that party to the full. Once the distribution of Goering's wine had taken place, Carson recalled that you could hear the champagne corks going off all day long. As the celebration got noisier, Captain Spears began to grow a bit worried that it would become excessive. Sergeant Messier, remembered by Private O'Keefe as our most professional soldier, got into the spirit of the day when he dressed in a full German officer's uniform, topped off with a monocle for his right eye. Someone got the bright idea to march him over to the company orderly room and turn him in at rifle point to Captain Spears. Someone got word to Spears before Mercier showed up. When troopers brought Mercier up to Spears' desk, prodding him with bayonets, Spears did not look up. One of the troopers snapped a salute and declared, "Sir, we have captured this German officer. What should we do with him?" "Take him out and shoot him," Spears replied, not looking up. "Sir," Mercier called out, "sir, please, sir, it's me, Sergeant Mercier." "Mercier, get out of that silly uniform," Spears ordered. Shortly thereafter, he called the company together. He said he noted that the men who were relatively new to the company were celebrating out of proportion to their contribution to the victory. He wanted it toned down. No more shooting off of weapons, for example, and especially not of German weapons, which made everyone jumpy when they went off. But trying to stop the celebration was like trying to stop the tide. Not even Spears could resist. Back in Company HQ, he and Sergeant Carson sat in the orderly room, popping champagne bottles, throwing the empties out the French doors. Soon there was a pile of empties outside. Spears and Carson went to the balcony for some fresh air. They looked at the bottles.
"Are you any good with that 45 pistol?" Spears asked.
Carson said he was. "Let's see you take the neck off one of those bottles." Carson aimed, fired, and shattered a bottle. Spears took his turn with the same results. Soon they were banging away. Sergeant Talbert came storming in, red-faced, ready to shoot the offenders of the company order. He saw Carson first. "Carson, I'll have your ass for this," he shouted. Just as he started explaining that Captain Spears had ordered no shooting, Spears stepped out from behind Carson, a smoking .45 in his hand. After a few seconds of silence, Spears spoke. "I'm sorry, Sergeant. I caused this. I forgot my own order." Webster, Lutz, and O'Keefe had meanwhile found their way to Goering's wine cellar. They were late. The other easy men had already been there, and Winters had withdrawn the guard, throwing the cellar open to anyone. As Webster, Lutz, and O'Keefe drove to the site in Lutz's Volkswagen, they saw a steady stream of German trucks, Volkswagens, even armored cars winding up the road to the officers' club. The last contingent of E Company men had a wooden box with them, which they stuffed with bottles. "I was shocked to find that most of the champagne was new and mediocre," Webster remarked. Here was no Napoleon brandy, and the champagne had been bottled in the late 1930s. I was disappointed in Hitler. What Webster failed to take into account was that Nixon had preceded him, and Nixon was a connoisseur of fine liquor. And he had picked out 5 truckloads for himself and the other officers long before Webster, also a self-styled connoisseur, arrived. "On this occasion," an amused Winters commented, "the Yale man, Nixon, pulled his rank on the Harvard boy." Outside the club, Webster, Lutz, and O'Keefe ran into a group of French soldiers drinking, shouting, "La guerre est finie, la guerre est finie," shooting their machine pistols into the sky, slapping the Americans on the back, asking for cigarettes, offering drinks. The Americans gave away cigarettes, shook hands all around, and took off, driving back to their apartment as fast as possible. And there, Webster wrote, began a party unequaled. Popping corks, spilling champagne, breaking bottles. Raucous laughter, ringing shouts, stuttering, lisping sentences. "Have a nusher glass. Here, goddammit, let me pop that cork. It's my turn. Isn't this wonderful? Schlug-a-lug, fill her up. Where's Hitler? We gotta thank Hitler, the son of a bitch. Berchtesgaden, I love you." And that was the end of the war. Everyone in Europe was celebrating, victor and vanquished. First among the celebrants were the young men in uniform. They had survived. They would live. They had the best cause to celebrate. On the morning of May 8th, O'Keefe and Harry Lager went looking for eggs. They came to a farmhouse in a clearing, smoke curling up from the chimney. They kicked the door in, then ran inside with rifles ready to fire and scared hell out of the 2 Italian deserters who jumped straight up and froze. There was a bottle of champagne on the table. With one quick motion, the Italian nearest it grabbed the neck of the bottle, stuck it out toward O'Keefe, whose rifle was pointed straight toward his stomach, and offered a drink, saying, "Pax!" The tension snapped. They drank to peace. The Americans left to continue their egg hunt. They came to a lodge in the woods. It was beautifully situated, O'Keefe wrote. A man in his late 20s in civilian clothes was standing on a low porch at the front of the house. As we came to the steps leading up to the porch, he stepped down with a smile on his face and said in English, "The war is over. I have been listening to the wireless." He was holding himself erect, but it was noticeable that he had a bad right leg. I glanced at it. He explained, "I was with the Africa Corps and was shot up badly and sent home. I was a soldier." He asked us to come in and have a glass of wine. We said no, but he said, "Wait, I'll bring it out." And he left to reappear with 3 glasses of wine. We raised them in salute as he said, "To the end of the war." We raised ours, and we all drank. There was something basically soldierly and right about it. They found some eggs, returned to their apartment, and celebrated the end of the war with scrambled eggs and Hitler's champagne. Chapter 18. The Soldier's Dream Life. Austria, May 8th through July 31st, 1945. Late on the afternoon of May 8th, Winters got orders to prepare 2nd Battalion to move out that night for Zell am See, Austria, some 30 kilometers south of Berchtesgaden, where it would take up occupation duty. At 2200 hours, the convoy began to roll, headlights on full beam. In the back of the trucks, the men continued their party, drinking, singing, gambling. When the convoy arrived at Zell am See in the morning, the men were dirty, unshaven, wearing grimy army fatigue pants and blouses. German soldiers were everywhere. Zell am See was as far south as the Wehrmacht could retreat. Beyond it were the peaks of the Alps, and beyond them, Italy. And all the passes were still closed by snow. There were, it turned out, about 25,000 armed German soldiers in the area of responsibility of 2nd Battalion, which numbered fewer than 600 men. The contrast in appearance was almost as great as the contrast in numbers. The conquering army looked sloppy, unmilitary, ill-disciplined. The conquered army looked sharp, with an impressive military appearance and obvious discipline. Winters felt that the German soldiers and Austrian civilians must have wondered, as they gazed fascinated at the first American troops to arrive in the area, how on earth they could have lost to these guys. Winters set up Battalion HQ in the village of Capron, 4 kilometers south of Zell am See. The valley was one of the most famous mountain resort areas in the world, especially popular with rich Germans. The accommodation, ranging from Zimmer frei at farmhouses to luxurious hotels, were stunning. All the rooms were occupied by wounded German soldiers. They had to move out, to be sent by truck or train to stockades in the Munich area. The Americans moved in. Their job was to maintain order, to gather in all German soldiers, disarm them, and ship them off to POW camps. Winters got started the morning of May 9th immediately upon arrival. He had the senior German commander in the area brought to him. "I was 27 years old," Winters recalls, "and like all troops, I was wearing a dirty, well-worn combat fatigue jacket and pants and had that bucket on my head for a helmet. I felt a little ridiculous giving orders to a professional German colonel about 20 years my senior, who was dressed in a clean field uniform with his medals all over his chest." Winters gave his orders anyway. He directed the colonel to see to the collection of all weapons in the area and to stack them in the airport, at the school, and in the churchyard. He gave officers permission to keep their sidearms and allowed German military police to retain their weapons. And he said that the following day he would inspect the German camps, troops, and kitchens. The next morning, May 10th, Winters and Nixon drove by jeep to inspect the arms dumps. They were shocked by what they saw. In all three locations, a mountain of weapons. Winters realized he had made a mistake when he said all weapons. He had meant military weapons, but the colonel had taken him too literally. There was a fantastic collection of hunting rifles, target rifles, hunting knives, antique firearms of all kinds, as well as a full division stock of military weapons. It seemed enough to start World War III. When he inspected the camps and kitchens, Winters found everything well organized. Troops were lined up for review, looking parade ground sharp, clean, well-dressed, in good condition. The kitchens were in good order. The cooks were making large kettles of potato soup over fires. Thereafter, Winters dealt with an English-speaking German staff officer who came to his HQ each morning to report and receive orders. There was no trouble. In Winters' words, "We left them alone. They respected us." The German staff officer would tell stories about his tour of duty on the Eastern Front and of fighting against the 101st in Bastogne. He told Winters, "Our armies should join hands and wipe out the Russian army." "No thanks," Winters replied. "All I want to do is get out of the army and go home." That was what nearly everyone wanted, none more than the German troops. Before any could be released, however, all had to be screened. The German encampments were crawling with Nazis, many of whom had put on enlisted men's uniforms to escape detection. The most notorious of these was Adolf Eichmann, wearing the uniform of a Luftwaffe corporal in a camp near Berchtesgaden. He managed to escape before he was detected, got to Argentina with his family, and lived well until 1960, when Israeli agents discovered his whereabouts, captured him in a daring commando raid, brought him to Israel for trial, and hanged him. Lieutenant Lipton was serving as leader of the machine gun platoon in HQ Command, 2nd Battalion. Winters assigned him to oversee a lager of several hundred prisoners. One of them was Ferdinand Porsche, designer of the Volkswagen and the Panther and Tiger tanks. In mid-May, Lipton cleared about 150 of the prisoners for release. The senior German officer, a colonel, asked permission to talk to them before they were let go. Lipton agreed. His talk was long and was a good one, Lipton recalled. He told them that Germany had lost the war, that they had been good soldiers and he was proud of them, and that they should go back to their homes and rebuild their lives. He said that all of them were needed for the reconstruction of Germany. When he finished, the men gave a loud cheer and took off. Other high-ranking German officials, men who had good reason to fear that they would be charged with war crimes, were hiding in the mountains. Spears was told by the DPs about a man who had been the Nazi head of the slave labor camps in the area and had committed a great many atrocities. He investigated, asked questions, and became convinced they were telling the truth. Further investigation revealed that this man was living on a small farm nearby. Spears called in First Lieutenant Lynch. He explained the situation, then gave his order. Take Moon, Liebgott, and Sisk. Find him and eliminate him. Lynch gathered the men, explained the mission, got a weapons carrier, and took off up the mountain. During the trip, Moon thought about his predicament. He was sure that Captain Spears did not have the authority to order an execution based on testimony from the DPs. But Spears was the company CO, and Moon was just an enlisted man carrying out an order. He decided, I'm not complying with this bullshit. If someone has to do the shooting, it won't be me. They got to the farm and, without a struggle, took the Nazi prisoner. Liebgott interrogated him for 30 minutes, then declared there could be no doubt this was the man they wanted, and he was guilty as charged. The Americans pushed the man at gunpoint to the weapons carrier, then drove off. Lynch stopped beside a ravine. They prodded the man out of the vehicle. Liebgott drew his pistol and shot him twice. The prisoner began screaming. He turned and ran up the hill. Lynch ordered Moon to shoot him. You shoot him, Moon replied. The war is over. Skinny Sisk stepped forward, leveled his M1 at the fleeing man, and shot him dead. After the POWs and DPs were sorted and shipped out of the area, the next job was to sort out and consolidate all the captured German equipment and the U.S. Army equipment no longer needed for combat. As the material was gathered and registered, convoys of trucks took it to depots in France. Officers were ordered to turn in the silk escape map of France they had received before the jump into Normandy, or be fined $75. As those maps were damn near sacred to the D-Day veterans, there was universal non-compliance. When told to pay the fine, Winters replied for the entire battalion, taking his line from General McAuliffe, nuts. The regimental supply officer, Captain Herbert Sobel, backed down. Given the absence of resistance, indeed the enthusiastic cooperation of the Germans and Austrians, by the end of the third week in May, there was little real work left for the Americans. All KP, washing clothes, cleaning quarters, or construction tasks were done by local residents anxious to make some money or receive food or cigarettes. Time was hanging heavy on the heads of the young men lusting to go home. Winters had a track built, a tennis court, and a baseball field, then a rifle range. Competitions were held between companies, battalions, regiments, all the way up to ETO. He held daily close-order drills. There were men who loved it. To the serious athletes, those with hopes of a future college or professional career, it was a marvelous opportunity to train. They were excused from all duties, lived in a separate athletic dorm, and got to practice or compete every day. To the few who planned to make a career of the Army, it was a chance to practice their profession. But to the majority, neither jocks nor career soldiers, it was a bore. They found their outlets in four other ways: as tourists in the Alps, hunting, drinking, and chasing women. The Zeller Zee, a lake some 4 kilometers in length and 2 in width, was a breathtaking bit of beauty and a joy to swim in on the long, sunny days of late May and early June. "My bathing suit is getting quite a workout," Webster wrote his mother on May 20th. "Will you please mail me another of very gaily colored trunks from Abercrombie and Fitch as quickly as possible? Waist 32, preferably shorts, not trunks." On the mountain behind Capron was a ski lodge. The chair lift to the lodge was kaput, but it could be reached by climbing the mountain trail. Winters set up a program to rotate one platoon every 3 days to the lodge for R&R. At the lodge, there were Austrian servants and cooks, ski instructors and hunting guides. The skiing was fabulous. So was the hunting for mountain goats. There were deer at a lower level, hundreds of them, as this was a prime hunting area for the European aristocracy. The 101st was at the end of the pipeline in the distribution of food. Everyone from the ports of Cherbourg and Le Havre, right on down the pipeline, had a crack at the food first, and they all had civilian girlfriends to take care of and a flourishing black market to tempt them. So not enough food was getting to the Alps. The paratroopers went out on hunting parties for deer. Venison became a staple in the diet. Private Freeman got a Browning shotgun and supplemented the venison with quail and other birds. Women, broads, dames, beetles, girls, skirts, frails, molls, babe, fräuleins, mademoiselles. "That's what the boys wanted," Webster wrote. He went on to describe the results. The cooks were keeping mistresses. The platoon lovers were patronizing the barn. McCreary had a married woman in town. Reese installed his in a private house. Carson fed an educated, beautiful, sophisticated Polish blonde, whom he later married. The platoon staff visited a DP camp nightly, and in Zell am Zee, home of the most beautiful women in Europe, the lads with the sunburned blondes were fulfilling their dreams. After talking about women for 3 years, they now had all they could want. It was the complete failure of the non-fraternization policy. For those who had wanted and could afford them, there had been women in London, Paris, along the Ruhr. But Webster observed, in Austria, where the women were cleaner, fairer, better built, and more willing than in any other part of Europe, the GIs had their field day. The flow of booze was never-ending. On May 28th, Webster wrote his parents, "Since leaving Berchtesgaden, we've had a bun on every night. 2 days ago, we hijacked a German Wehrmacht warehouse to the tune of a couple of cases of gin, 48 bottles all told. Your package with the orange juice powder, therefore, came in very handy." Captain Spears had only one standing order about the drinking: no drunkenness outside. This was strictly enforced by the sergeants, who wanted no incidents with drunken soldier boys on guard duty or just wandering the streets and mountain paths. In their quarters, however, the men were free to drink all they could hold. Most of them drank more than that. Webster's squad kept a pitcher of iced tea and gin full and handy. Each night, he wrote, by 8 o'clock, Matthews was lisping and stuttering. Marsh was bragging about his squad and how they obeyed him. Schulte was sitting quietly on a bed, grinning. Wynne was laughing and shouting and talking about Bastogne. McCreary was boasting of his courage. "There ain't nobody in this platoon braver than I am, buddy," with immodesty but complete truth. Gilmore was pressing clothes furiously, a peculiar and most welcome manifestation of his high spirits. Hale slobbered and poured himself another drink. Chris, who never got rowdy, sat back in cold silence. Raider had passed out in the armchair, and I, who had passed out gracefully and without a struggle, was sound asleep. The lads would work off their hangovers with an afternoon swim or game of softball. Winters was a non-drinker who neither approved nor disapproved of drinking. His two best friends, Welsh and Nixon, were heavy drinkers. He never berated anyone for getting drunk on his own time. Had he ever been tempted to do so, He got a reminder each afternoon of why these excesses were taking place. The boys would wear shorts and nothing else in the warm sun while they played softball. Nearly every one of them had at least one scar. Some men had two, three, or even four scars on their chest, back, arms, or legs. And keep in mind, he concluded, that at Caprun, I was looking only at the men who were not seriously wounded. There was another reminder of the price that E Company and the others had paid to get to where they were. On June 5th, at 2200 hours, the men celebrated the first anniversary of their jump into Normandy. Webster was struck by the contrast. A year earlier, at 2200 hours, my heart was beating like Jean Krupa's drum, and my stomach was tied up and very empty. Now I am sitting in a cozy house in the Austrian Alps. I have a tall glass of iced tea and gin in one hand, my pen in the other. A lot of boys who took off from that Devonshire airport are dead, buried in lovely cemeteries in Sainte-Mère-Église, Zon, and in Belgium. But I'm still here and very thankful for it, and tonight we shall remember them in a way they would have thought most fitting, by having a wild, noisy party. The officers, too, were having an ongoing party. Spears had snatched a couple of cases of fine brandy, which he enjoyed in his living quarters with a beautiful Polish DP and her small child. Colonel Sink gave some memorable parties at his HQ, the Hotel Zell. One night he invited all 506 officers to meet General Taylor and his staff. It was a bash. Colonel Strayer, who, according to Lieutenant Foley, could put away quite a bit of liquor, got a little rambunctious. He got into a fist fight with a general. Lieutenant Foley and a couple of others got a bright idea. They went to the parking lot and siphoned most of the gas from General Taylor's Mercedes. It had belonged to Hitler. They thought it would be very funny when it ran out of gas on his way back to Berchtesgaden in the middle of the night. The next morning, Sunday, Colonel Sink ordered a special officer's call. They assembled outside the hotel. Sink laid into them. He said their behavior was disgraceful. He touched especially on the brawling and on the practical joke. He had just gotten off the phone with General Taylor, whose car had run out of gas, and who had sat there for hours while his driver searched for a jerry can. Foley, who did not confess, reported that Sink didn't give a damn whether enlisted men stopped and listened. He was angry and he didn't care who heard him give every one of us hell, spelled H-E-L-L. Sink never stayed mad long. A week later he laid on a huge 4th of July celebration. But on the 4th it rained, and again on the 5th. Never mind, the 6th was a beautiful day and the celebration began. Sink on the 6th, the men called it. There were athletic events of all kinds. Gliders and sailplanes sailed across the lake, riding the mountain currents. Troop Carrier Command lent the regiment a C-47 for the afternoon, and there was a jump of 12 men into the lake. Food and drink was plentiful. In the park, local musicians, dressed in lederhosen, played all the Papa tunes. The GIs requested pop songs from America, but the Austrians needed practice. Everyone danced. All the girls wore DP armbands. Non-fraternization applied only to Germans and Austrians. DPs were exempt. The armbands DPs wore to distinguish themselves were lavishly distributed to the local mountain girls. But as Lieutenant Foley remembered it, there wasn't one displaced person at the celebration. Mountain weather, unlimited sports, women and booze, easy duty, good hunting, and a hard-assed colonel whom everybody loved, Zell Amze provided, in Webster's view, the soldier's dream life. It should have been the most perfect summer ever for the men of E Company. In fact, after the first couple of weeks, most of them hated it. They were frustrated by the army bureaucracy. They were bored. They were drinking far too much, and they wanted to go home. Getting home depended on points, which became virtually the sole topic of conversation and led to much bad feeling. The point system set up by the army gave a man points for each active duty service month, points for campaigns, points for medals, points for being married. The magic number was 85 points. Those with that many or more were eligible for immediate shipment home and discharge. Those with fewer points were doomed to stay with the division, presumably right on through to the big jump in China or Japan. So for the first time in their army careers, the officers and men became seriously concerned with medals. A bronze star was worth 5 points. Inevitably, the army's hierarchical and bureaucratic systems played favorites. Lieutenant Foley recalled the regimental adjutant who picked up a bronze star for, according to rumor, selecting the Hotel Zell for Sink's HQ. The men of Easy felt cheated in another way. In the paratroopers, it had been damn near impossible to win a medal other than the Purple Heart. In the 101st, for example, Webster wrote, only 2 men had been awarded the Medal of Honor, a private and a lieutenant colonel from the 502nd. They had both been killed in action. Major Winters, who had acquired it legitimately in a fracas with a German battery in Normandy, wore the only Distinguished Service Cross in the 2nd Battalion. In E Company, Captain Spears and 2 or 3 others had 100-proof silver stars, and about 12 men displayed bronze stars. Of Purple Hearts, there were a plenty. But that was not a decoration, but a badge of office, infantry. Most of the men in E Company had, for decorations, only the 4 battle stars on their ETO ribbon. No more than a personnel clerk who had never left base camp. There was McClung, for instance, Webster complained. He was quiet, lanky, and unimpressive, and nobody noticed him. But his buddies in the 3rd Platoon swore that old One Lung had killed more Germans than any other man in the battalion. McClung could smell Kraut. He hunted them. He pursued them in dawn attacks and on night patrols. He went out of his way to kill them, took more chances, and volunteered for more dangerous jobs than any other man in E Company. McClung had made every day of Normandy, Holland, and Bastogne, and what did he have to show for it? An ETO ribbon and 4 battle stars. Sergeant Shifty Powers was in the same category. As good a soldier as there was in the 101st, he had no medals, no Purple Heart, so not enough points. But the grumbling had grown to such proportions that General Taylor decided to have a drawing in each company. The winner would be rotated home. Powers did not want to attend the drawing. "Hell, Paul," he told Sergeant Rogers, "I've never won anything in my life." But Rogers persuaded him to go, and he won. Immediately, another soldier offered Powers $1,000 for that trip home. Powers recalled, "I thought about that for a while. $1,000 was a lot of money. But finally I said, no, I think I'll just go home." Powers gathered up his loot, mainly pistols, got his paperwork done, drew his back pay, and joined the 10 other lucky men for a ride to Munich. Going around a curve, a GI truck hit their truck head-on. Powers flew out and over the top of the truck, hit the pavement, broke some bones, and got a bad concussion. Another one of the lucky soldiers was killed. Powers went to a hospital where he lost all his back pay and souvenirs to thieves. He eventually got home via a hospital ship months after the comrades he had left behind. Adding to the frustration of seeing cooks and clerks get the same points as frontline infantry was the haphazard record-keeping. All the men spent hours totaling up their points, but the trick was to convince the regimental adjutant's office. Webster was sure he had 87 points, but his records indicated he had fewer than 80. General Taylor tried to help his veterans. He decreed that every man who had taken part in Normandy, Holland, and Belgium, or who had made 2 of those campaigns and missed a 3rd because of wounds, would receive a bronze star. This was widely appreciated, of course, but temporarily caused more frustration because it took weeks after Taylor's announcement before the medal and citation, and with them the all-important 5 points, actually came through. All this chicken stuff created intense dissatisfaction with the army and its ways. Recruiters were circulating among the officers and men, trying to persuade them to join the regular army. Almost none did. Webster articulated the feeling of most of his fellow soldiers. "I hate this army with a vehemence so deep and undying, I'll never speak good of it as long as I live," he wrote his parents. I consider my time spent in the army as 90% wasted. The only thing that he would concede was, I did learn how to get along with people. When Sink offered Winters a regular commission, Winters thought about it for a moment or two, and then said he would rather not. Adding to the problems of frustration and anger caused by the point system was the combination of too much liquor, too many pistols, and too many captured vehicles. Road accidents were almost as dangerous to the 101st in Austria as the German army had been in Belgium. In the first 3 weeks in Austria, there were 70 wrecks, more in the 6 weeks of June and July. 20 men were killed, nearly 100 injured. One night, Sergeant Robert Marsh was driving Private John Janovec back from a roadblock by a side road. Janovec was leaning on the unreliable door of a German truck. They hit a log. He lost his balance, fell, and hit his head on the pavement. Marsh rushed him to the regimental aid station in Zell am See, but he died on the way of a fractured skull. Captain Spears gathered up his few personal possessions, a watch, his wings, his wallet, and his parachute scarf, and mailed them to Janovic's parents. He had come a long way, Webster wrote. He had jumped in Holland and fought in Bastogne. He hated the army, and now when the war is over and the golden prospect of home was in sight, he had died. Marsh had not been drinking. Easy Company was proud of its record with regard to mounting guard duty or manning roadblocks with sober, responsible soldiers and in not driving drunk. Others were not so careful. Private O'Keefe recalled a night he was at a roadblock with Private Lloyd Gee, halfway between Zalfelden and Zell am See. An open German staff car came barreling down the road, not prepared to stop. Gee and I jumped out in front of it and made them stop. There were two men dressed in German uniforms, both drunk. What the hell you stopping us for? We're on your side. They were a couple of our paratroopers, but from some other company. We told them, damn it, you could have got your heads blown off. They finally promised to slow down on the driving. We told them the next guard post was about 10 miles up the road, to keep an eye out for it and to slow down to a crawl. They promised to take it easy. But when we got back, we learned that those two damn fools had barreled right through Welling's post with Welling out yelling, halt, halt! After the third halt, Welling took one shot and hit the driver. Later, Welling visited the wounded man in the hospital. He said he had no hard feelings toward Welling, that he would have done the same thing. Sergeant Chuck Grant, an original Tocoa man, was a smiling, athletic, fair-haired Californian who was universally respected. He had knocked out an 88 in Holland, and liked. One night he was driving a couple of privates to a roadblock for a changing of the guard. As they arrived, he saw a commotion. A drunken GI was standing with a pistol in his hand, two dead Germans at his feet. He had stopped them in their vehicle and demanded gasoline, as he was out. But he had no German, they had no English. He concluded they were resisting and shot them. A British major from military intelligence happened to have been driving by. He and his sergeant got out of their jeep to see what was going on. The drunken GI pointed his pistol at them and told them to back off. At that moment, Grant came driving past. The drunk took a shot at him but missed. The major made a move to disarm the man. The GI turned on him and shot him dead. Then his sergeant. Grant came running over. The drunk shot him in the brain, then ran off. Spears thought the world of Grant. When he heard of the shooting, he and Lieutenant Foley jumped in a jeep, drove to the site, got Grant on a stretcher, and roared off for the regimental aid station. The doctor there was a disgrace, unshaven, unkempt, wearing a badly stained shirt. He took a quick look at Grant and said there was no hope. Bullshit, said Spears, who put Grant back on the stretcher and roared off again, this time for Zalfelden. Spears had heard there were some German specialists there. One of them was a brain specialist from Berlin. He operated immediately and saved Grant's life. Word of the shooting flashed through the billets. E Company went out en masse to find the culprit. He was found trying to rape an Austrian girl in Zell am See. He was a recent replacement in Company I. To the expressed disgust of many of the men, he was brought back to Company HQ alive. He almost wished he hadn't been. Half the company was milling around him, threatening, kicking, swearing vengeance. Before anything more serious happened, Captain Spears came rushing in straight from the hospital. "Where's the weapon?" Spears shouted at the prisoner.
"What weapon?"
Spears pulled his pistol, reversed his grip to hold it by the barrel, and hit the man right in the temple with the butt. He started screaming, "When you talk to an officer, you say, 'Sir,'" and hit him again. The GI slumped into a chair, stunned. Private Hack Hansen from Grant's 2nd Platoon and close buddy came running in. He whipped out his pistol. "You son of a bitch," he cursed. "I've killed better men than you." He put the pistol right in the man's face. Four men grabbed Hansen from behind and tried to pull him away, shouting that death was too good for such a coward, but he pulled the trigger. The pistol misfired. "You ought to have seen the look of that guy," Gordon Carson remarked. They beat him unconscious, then carried him to the regimental guardhouse and turned him over to the provost sergeant. When he revived, the provost sergeant beat him until the blood ran. Sink came to Company HQ. He strode in and asked Sergeant Carson, "Where's Spears?"
"Up on the second floor, sir."
Sink went up and got the facts from Spears. It took the better part of an hour. Sink left and Spears came down.
"How'd it go?" Carson asked.
"Pretty rough."
"Well, what did he say?"
"He said I should have shot the son of a bitch."
That he did not is remarkable. One explanation I got from a number of men was that Spears must have had some doubt that the arrested man was the right man. When I asked Spears about this, he replied, "As to the Sergeant Grant shooting, you have it right. There must have been doubt in my mind because summary action never troubled me." But I wonder if there was not another factor at work. Spears was not the only man who had a chance to shoot the coward. Grant had an opportunity in the initial encounter. The man who found the I Company drunk could have shot him on the spot, and nearly every man in the company interviewed by me said he wished it had been done. Many of them were at Company HQ when he was brought in, wearing pistols, but only one of them actually tried to kill the man, and he was being held back by four others. Almost every man in that room had killed. Their blood was up, their anger was deep and cold. But what stands out in the incident is not the pistol whippings and beatings, but the restraint. They had had enough of killing. Shortly after the incident, Captain Spears wrote a long letter to Sergeant Forrest Guth, who was in hospital in England, and who had written Spears expressing a fear that he would be transferred to another division. Spears liked Guth, thought he was a good soldier, and was appreciative of his ability to keep all his weapons in prime condition. He especially appreciated the way Guth could take a file and work on the tripper housing of an M1 and make it fully automatic. Winters got one of those Guth specials. He kept it, and when he set off for the Korean War, took it with him. Unfortunately, Guth cannot remember today how he did it. In his reply, Spears expressed another side of himself. It was a long, chatty letter about the doings of E Company since Guth went to the hospital, full of the kind of information Guth most wanted to hear. Lutz fell off a motorcycle and hurt his arm. Not seriously, though. Sergeant Talbert didn't like being first sergeant, so I gave him the 2nd Platoon. And Sergeant Lynch, 2nd Platoon, is first sergeant now. Sergeant Alley got drunk again and we had to bust him. Lieutenant Lipton is on furlough in Scotland and is very happy. I'm sweating out a furlough to England to see my wife and baby. Sergeant Powers was on his way home and the truck overturned and he fractured his skull and he is hospitalized. Sergeant Stroll, 3rd Platoon, is on his way home to the States. Chuck Grant got in the way of a bullet from a drunk American and his head is not too good. He is in a German hospital near here and is getting better. Sergeant Malarkey just came back from a long stretch in the hospital. Sergeant Reinhardt just came from the Riviera. McGrath won't take a furlough. He is saving his money. Spears gave Guth the details on the Bronze Star he was entitled to for participation in Normandy, Holland, and Belgium, and promised to inform him as soon as it came through. He added a postscript. Clark is armorer artificer just now, sent Burlingame back to his platoon. He couldn't keep your crowd generator going. We have regular electricity and hot water here in Austria.
By the way, you can wear your presidential unit citation ribbon and an oak leaf cluster on it no matter what outfit you're in. You earned it with the 101st AB. The company was breaking up. General Taylor ordered all High Point men who had not yet been rotated home to be transferred to the 501 stationed in Berchtesgaden. The 501st was being inactivated and was to serve as a vehicle to transport all High Point men from the division back to the United States for discharge. Others from the old company were in hospital or already discharged. Recruits who had joined up at Mourmelon or Haguenau were now regarded as veterans. General Taylor made a trip to the States. When he returned toward the end of June, he announced that the 101st was to be redeployed to the Pacific after a winter furlough in the States. Meanwhile, the War Department insisted that the division undergo a full training regime, a critical process if it was to go into combat again, as more than three-quarters of the division was made up of recruits. So close-order drill and calisthenics became the order of the day again, along with nomenclature of the M1, nomenclature and functioning of the BAR, and nomenclature and functioning of the carbine. A road march, arm and hand signals, squad tactics, barracks inspection, mess kit inspection, military courtesy and discipline, first aid and sanitation, clothing check, map reading, dry run with the rifle, one solid week of triangulation, firing on the range. Thus it went, Webster wrote, and I with it in mounting disgust. Lieutenant Peacock returned, more chicken shit than ever. We suffered his excesses of training to such a degree, Webster wrote, that the men who had known him in Holland and Bastogne hated even to look at him. I was so mad and exasperated that if I had possessed fewer than 85 points, I would have volunteered to go straight to Japan and fight rather than put up with another day's basic under Peacock. By the middle of July, every veteran of Normandy was gone, except the long-suffering Webster, who still could not get the adjutant to accept his point total. Colonel Sink had given the High Point men a farewell speech. "It is with mingled feelings that your regimental commander observes the departure of you fine officers and men. He is happy for each of you. You have worked and fought and won the right to return to your homes and to your friends. I am sorry to see you go, because you are friends and comrades at arms. Most of you have caught hell at one time or another from me. I hope you considered it just hell and fair. It was never intended to be otherwise. I told you people to get those presidential citations, and you did it. It will forever be to your credit and honor. Then God speed you on your way. May the same fellow who led you by the hand in Normandy, Holland, Bastogne, and Germany look kindly upon you and guard you until the last great jump." At the end of July, the division was transferred by 40 and 8s to France. E Company went into barracks in Joigny, a small town south of Paris. Winters, Spears, Foley, and others took furloughs in England. On August 6th, the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, laying to rest the fears of another campaign in the Pacific. After that, everything in the airborne was in flux, with Low Point men being transferred into the 17th Airborne, others into the 82nd. The 101st magazine, The Screaming Eagle, complained, "The outfit seems more like a repel-depel than a combat division." On August 11th, Colonel Sink was promoted to assistant division commander. On August 22nd, General Taylor left the 101st, or what was left of it, to become superintendent at West Point. Shortly thereafter, the 506th packed up and moved out to join the 82nd Airborne in Berlin. It was said that Colonel Sink cried when his boys marched to the Joigny Depot for shipment to the 82nd. Webster thought it fitting that he do so, as he was the heart and soul of our regiment. Writing in 1946, Webster went on, "Our beautiful dark blue silk regimental flag with Mount Currahee, the bolt of lightning, and the six parachutes embroidered on it is rolled in its case, gathering dust in the National Archives in Washington." On November 30th, 1945, the 101st was inactivated.
Easy Company no longer existed. The company had been born in July 1942 at Toccoa. Its existence essentially came to an end almost exactly 3 years later in Zell am See, Austria. In those 3 years, the men had seen more, endured more, and contributed more than most men can see, endure, or contribute in a lifetime. They thought the army was boring, unfeeling, and chicken, and hated it. They found combat to be ugliness, destruction, and death, and hated it. Anything was better than the blood and carnage, the grime and filth, the impossible demands made on the body. Anything, that is, except letting down their buddies. They also found in combat the closest brotherhood they ever knew. They found selflessness. They found they could love the other guy in their foxhole more than themselves. They found that in war, men who loved life would give their lives for them. They had had three remarkable men as company commanders: Herbert Sobel, Richard Winters, and Ronald Spears. Each had made his own impact, but Winters, who had been associated with the company from day one to day 1,095, had made the deepest impression. In the view of those who served in Easy Company, it was Dick Winters' company. The non-coms especially felt that way. The ones who served as corporals and sergeants in combat had been privates in Toccoa. They had spent their entire 3 years in E Company. Officers, except Winters, came and went. Many of the officers continued their association with E Company as members of the battalion or regimental staff. But only Winters and the non-coms were present and accounted for, or in hospital, every day of the company's existence. They held it together, most of all in those awful shellings in the woods of Bastogne, and at that critical moment in the attack on Foy before Spears replaced Dyke. The acknowledged leaders of the non-coms, on paper and in fact, were the first sergeants, William Evans, James Deal, Carwood Lipton, and Floyd Talbert. Sergeant Talbert was in the hospital at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana, on September 30, 1945. He wrote a letter to Winters. He was no Webster as a writer, but he wrote from the heart, and he spoke for every man who ever served in Easy Company. He said he wished they could get together to talk, as there were a lot of things he wanted to tell Winters. "The first thing I will try to explain is, Dick, you are loved and will never be forgotten by any soldier that ever served under you, or I should say with you, because that is the way you led. You are to me the greatest soldier I could ever hope to meet. A man can get something from war that is impossible to acquire any place else. It always seemed to strengthen my self-confidence or something. I don't know why I'm telling you this. You know all that. Well, I will cut this off for now. You are the best friend I ever had, and I only wish we could have been on a different basis. You were my ideal and motor in combat. The little major we both know summed you up in two words: the most brave and courageous soldier he ever knew. And I respected his judgment very much. He was a great soldier, too, and I informed him you were the greatest. Well, you know now why I would follow you into hell. When I was with you, I knew everything was absolutely under control." Winters felt as strongly about the men as they did about him. In 1991, he summed up his company's history and its meaning. "The 101st Airborne was made up of hundreds of good, solid companies. However, E Company, 506th PIR, stands out among all of them through that very special bond that brings men together. That extra special, elite, close feeling started under the stress Captain Sobel created at Camp Toccoa. Under that stress, the only way the men could survive was to bond together. Eventually, the non-coms had to bond together in a mutiny. The stress in training was followed by the stress in Normandy of drawing the key combat mission for gaining control of Utah Beach. In combat, your reward for a good job done is that you get the next tough mission. E Company kept right on getting the job done through Holland, Bastogne, Germany. The result of sharing all that stress throughout training and combat has created a bond between the men of E Company that will last forever. Chapter 19. Post-War Careers, 1945 through 1991. 48 members of Easy Company had given their lives for their country. More than 100 had been wounded, many of them severely, some twice, a few three times, one four times. Most had suffered stress, often severe. All had given what they regarded as the best years of their lives to the war. They were trained killers, accustomed to carnage and quick, violent reactions. Few of them had any college education before the war. The only skill most of them possessed was that of combat infantrymen. They came out determined to make up for lost time. They rushed to college using the GI Bill of Rights, universally praised by the veterans as the best piece of legislation the United States government ever conceived. They got married and had kids as quickly as possible. Then they set out to build a life for themselves. They were remarkably successful, primarily because of their own determination, ambition, and hard work, partly thanks to what they had taken from their Army experience that was positive. In the Army, they had learned self-confidence, self-discipline, and obedience, that they could endure more than they had ever thought possible, that they could work with other people as part of a team. They had volunteered for the paratroopers because they had wanted to be with the best and to be the best that they could be. They had succeeded. They wanted nothing less from civilian life, and there, too, they succeeded. They had a character like a rock, these members of the generation born between 1910 and 1928. They were the children of the Depression, fighters in the greatest war in history, builders of and participants in the post-war boom. They had accepted a hand up in the GI Bill, but they never took a hand out. They made their own way. A few of them became rich. A few became powerful. Almost all of them built their houses and did their jobs and raised their families and lived good lives, taking full advantage of the freedom they had helped to preserve. It seems appropriate to start with the severely wounded. Corporal Walter Gordon had been shot in the back in Bastogne and paralyzed. After 6 weeks in hospital in England, lying helplessly in his Crutchfield tongs, he began to have some feelings in his extremities. He had been helped by Dr. Stadium, who would stand at the foot of his bed and provoke him. "You're nothing but a goddamn gold brick, Gordon." Gordon would stiffen, snap back, get angry. "Because Stadium would not give up on him," Gordon says, "it never occurred to me that I could be a hopeless cripple." When the tongs came off, Stadium got him to walking, or at least shuffling. In the spring of 1945, Gordon was listed as walking wounded and sent by hospital ship back to the States, where he slowly recuperated at Lawson General Hospital in Atlanta. He was there when the war in Europe ended. He walked with pain in the back. He sat with pain in the back. He slept with it. Any physical work was far beyond his capabilities. He was obviously of no further use to the Army. By the middle of June, his father was demanding to know when he would be discharged. "I don't know," was all Gordon could reply. On June 16th, Gordon had an examination. The young doctor then told him he was being transferred to Fort Benning, listed as fit for limited duty. So far as Gordon could make out, his reason was, "Nerve wounds are slow to heal, and to discharge a veteran with my degree of disability would justify a substantial award of compensation. By retaining me for additional months, my condition would no doubt improve." Gordon called his father to give him the news. His father went into a tirade. He pointed out to me that I had been wounded twice and was now, in his words, a cripple. He felt that I had done my fair share and the time had come for me to return home. He then gave his son an order to pass along a message to the Army doctor. Gordon did as told, although with some embarrassment. He began by running on about how this was a message from his father and that he disavowed any connection with it. "Get on with it," the doctor barked, indicating how busy he was. My father says to tell you that if I am sent to any location other than home, he will come fetch me and fly me to Washington, D.C., and if necessary, strip me to the waist on the floor of the Senate. The doc's face fell.